Welcome to All About Business with me, James Reed, the podcast that covers everything about business, management, and leadership. Every episode, I sit down with different guests who have bootstrapped companies, masterminded investment models, or built a business empire. They're leaders in their field, and they're here to give you top insights and actionable advice so that you can apply their ideas to your own career or business venture. What happens when losing your job unexpectedly leads to building a global design business? Today on All About Business, I'm joined by Tom Faulkner, whose company started in the early 1990s, making hand-painted tables, and has since evolved into an internationally recognized luxury furniture brand. In this episode, we discuss how the business began by accident, the role of craft in a modern design company, and how a workshop in Swindon came to serve a global market. Well, today on All About Business, I'm really delighted to welcome Tom Faulkner. Tom is an award-winning British furniture designer and the founder of Tom Faulkner Limited, which is renowned for creating distinctive, handcrafted, sculptural luxury furniture. Tom has two showrooms, one in London and one in New York, and he has a fabrication centre workshop, I should call it, in Swindon, Wiltshire. So, Tom, you're London, New York, Swindon, which I'm very pleased to celebrate. Thank you for coming to talk to me.
I understand you're
a sort of accidental entrepreneur, or you started off doing something else and then changed tack. What happened, Tom? Tell us the story.
Well, yeah, I guess like lots of entrepreneurs in a way, it's kind of accidental. And I think kind of luck does play a big part in everybody's life somehow. But I once had a job and I worked for a company called Chrysalis Records, which was a well-known record company, still is. And I sort of had this idea that I wanted to work in music, and I'd been sort of trying to do that for some time. But in my spare time, I'd been kind of painting these tabletops, and I developed this kind of way of putting patterns onto tables with lots of color and stencils and stuff. And I was making them for myself, and I made some for my friends, and I made a few for my mum. And then unexpectedly, I was made redundant or fired from Chrysalis Record. I'm not quite sure what it was quite, because in those days, there was no one knew anything about the formalities of these things. And I certainly didn't as a kind of 27-year-old.
Yeah, so what happened?
Well, the boss, he got me into his office and he made me wait for 45 minutes while he was on the phone. And then he said, Tom, we've got a part company. And I thought he was leaving. I thought I was so sad. You know, off you go. Yeah.
But and, it wasn't
and,
him. It was
and
you.
It was actually me. And then I remember I stood on.
He made you sit there for 45 minutes before he just told you that.
Yeah, and he wasn't. There's no notice or anything. I mean, I didn't know what I was might have been entitled to or anything. Anyway, so that was fine. I mean, it was a bit of a blow because I'd spent a long time trying to.
Well, you must be quite upset.
Forge this career in music, which I thought would be great. And part of that, I'd worked for a year in the Virgin Megastore, you know, so I'd done a lot of work towards it. Anyway, so I stood on the platform at Latimer Road and I did feel a bit kind of sort of disheartened and depressed. And then I thought I would have a go. I'd start this, my painted tabletops. I thought I'd start a business and I did. And it was called Tom Faulkner Hand Painted Furniture. But at that moment I had orders, you know, I remember I had £1,000 worth of orders. So from various.
So this
people.
Was like what would be called these days a sort of side hustle.
A side hustle,
It became your main thing.
Yeah, exactly. It was my hobby. And then
who were your early customers? So you mentioned your mother, some friends. Mostly, so you had people who knew liked what you were doing.
Yeah, and I would refurbish their entire table. They'd give me their old brown table and I can paint it and sort of give back to them in their own colours. And, you know, it was good. You know,
so
people did
these
like
were
it.
Like artworks, really?
They were artworks in a way, yeah. 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 And there are still some of them exist in the world, but not many.
I'm pleased to hear that. So they're particularly precious, those.
Well, I can imagine they are, yeah.
Yes, but, so look after them if you've got one. An early Tom Faulkner.
So they were, so my friends were buying them. So the important thing, so I started that, and I had once worked for a picture framer previously, and I think that they had a kind of workshop and a shop. They had a store in Gray's Inn Antique Market, and they had a workshop in Wandsworth. Right. But I really liked the whole vibe of the kind of the workshop and I was making the frames and decorating the mounts and also getting the lunch and doing these things. It was a very small business. So, and I loved the shop as well, dealing with the public And when I thought I'd start my business with the painted tables, I thought I'd really start something like the picture framers. I thought, what a great, that's such a nice kind of thing to be doing. I thought I'd have a little workshop and a shop. And that's sort of what I've kind of got now.
Right.
A slightly bigger one, but it was still what it is.
In essence, an artisan.
Yeah, exactly. Approach. Still making things. And I really like the kind of interaction with the public and the clients and the customers.
Yeah.
But the key thing that happened for me, so I was painting painting my tabletops. It was quite a labor intensive sort of thing to do because they were, you know, quite involved, the patterns. But it was really fun finding out how to do it, how to do the lacquer, how to finish them. And, you know, I got them to, you know, they were very well done in the end. And I really liked the kind of discovery in the craft. And then I was doing an exhibition at the kind of, something at Earl's Court, which was quite a big show. And I'd done other small shows like the Bath Craft Show and things like that.
Yes.
And anyway, so I was doing this exhibition and I needed a chair to sit on. And my mother, funny enough, had met these fabricators it's a longer story, but somehow she'd met them in Wiltshire. And she said, why don't you go and ask this guy, Peter Reed, he'll make you a chair. Because I was talking about getting a chair to sit on.
So Peter was in Swindon, was he?
Yeah. And yeah. I didn't want the plastic chairs they had at the show.
No.
So I thought I'd make my own one. I thought, how cool to make a metal chair. And so I went to see them and they made me a metal chair. And that was the first thing I made out of metal. And that was kind of a sort of huge kind of moment of discovery in a way. I thought what you can do with metal and how they'd kind of manipulated it, how they'd bent it. And I thought, how great, maybe I could make some metal things myself.
So did people comment on your nice chair?
A lot, yeah.
Like,
yeah,
so you saw that there was interest
in it
as well.
It was a big part of the show. I mean, it was it looked like something, it looked something important. It had sort of spikes on the back, which was a bit odd and a bit kind of gothic.
So it was definitely sort of unique.
Yeah, it was certainly unique. And I mean, I wouldn't recommend having a chair with spikes on the back, but there are still some of those in existence. But anyway,
He just made that.
Made
for you.
The chair, yeah. And I thought, how amazing. And then I thought I could make bases to go beneath my table. So I suddenly got very interested in what was going on underneath the tables, having before only really been interested in the tops. So I started making sort of more kind of. I just suddenly realized that tables didn't need to have four legs. You could make a single pedestal or anything, you know, you could do anything you wanted underneath. I didn't realize, because I didn't know anything about furniture, because I wasn't that interested in furniture, because I was interested in surfaces and painting and decoration and patterns. So I had no kind of knowledge of the furniture world or any furniture designers or anything. So I hadn't never really looked that closely at any furniture.
But it sounds like you suddenly became very interested in furniture.
I became very interested in in the kind of shapes and what I could do.
Yes.
Yeah, I think somehow I had to channel my interests into my sort of creative, what I wanted to design, I decided to make all my ideas, I decided to make into tables, basically.
Right.
So they were small scale, but that was it. And then the last thing that happened on the journey of the accidental entrepreneurship is, so I was subcontracting to this man in Swindon called Peter Reed. And he had his own side hustle, which is a septic tank business.
Right.
And he wanted to spend more time with his septic tanks. So he decided, I was virtually his only customer. So he asked me if I'd like to take over his business in Swindon. And it had two employees, one called Nigel and one called Gordon. And I thought that sounds like a fun thing to do. So I took over, I borrowed some money, actually, bought all his machines, bought the whole business for £5,000.
Right.
And I got.
What
and
year
I,
was this?
It's 1996, 30 right. years.
So
it was
30
years ago
going,
today, almost.
Well, fantastic. Well, congratulations
and,
on
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
yeah.
Anyway, so
that
I did
was a good buy, wasn't
that
it?
That was a good buy, yeah. And I took, and
two,
I had Nigel
colleagues.
And Gordon, yeah. And I, you know, I didn't had no idea. So then I was sort of trapped in the world of metalwork. I had to kind of make more things in metal and design more things because I had this workshop. So I was quite committed without really realizing that, you know, that I was
so
committed.
So tell me, Tom, what happened to Nigel and Gordon?
So, well, Nigel still works for me.
Still works for you after 30 years 30, later?
30 years later.
Well, that's an endorsement.
That is, he's amazing. Nigel was an extraordinary person, incredibly talented. He had an apprenticeship at British Rail. So he did a really proper kind of, I don't know, 3-year apprenticeship.
Yeah.
So he knows everything about metalwork, coppersmithing, silversmithing, all the trades. And he's a very creative thinker. He's really an exceptional person and obviously very kind of loyal to me and the brand and what we've built. But he's still making. He's never wanted to be, you know, head of social media or anything. He's literally.
Thank goodness.
He's still making things and he does all the product development work. And he's, you know, if you want to know how to make something, you go to Nigel. And then there's Gordon, who was his sort of sidekick. I sometimes describe them as being like Asterix and Obelix because Nigel was like, if you know those characters.
Very fond of those characters. Well, yeah.
Nigel was like Asterix, small, extremely clever. And Gordon was his friend who was big and strong and faithful. And they kind of worked. They were very interesting, just good team together.
Like Asterix and Obelix.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They're there and they really, you know, Nigel insisted that Gordon came with him as part of the deal when I was doing it. Anyway, so but Gordon retired 10 years ago, I think.
Yes.
And Gordon's son actually works for me now, Nick Ball.
Well, that's fantastic. Yeah,
and his daughter has occasionally worked for me, but she's now gone off to be an actress.
Good for
her. So there we go.
Well, good luck to her in that career. You've developed the business and you've stayed in Swindon over 30 years now.
Yeah.
So you're obviously committed for fabricating in Britain.
Yes.
And you've grown your team there, as I understand. Yeah. What's happening there now?
Well, we now have, I mean, in Swindon, there are about, I think, 30 people in the business altogether. Or 31, I can't quite remember. There's 31 people on the WhatsApp group. That's all I know. But there's,
you know, that's how you know your payroll.
Yeah, exactly. But some people, good. I mean.
So when you join your business, you have to join the WhatsApp group.
There is a big WhatsApp group. Yeah. You don't have to. You just, actually.
Why wouldn't you, I suppose?
Well, not everybody. And Nick Ball doesn't have WhatsApp for some reason. I just don't know why not. But anyway, so he's not on it. But anyway.
Okay.
So there's 30. So there's of those people, probably there's kind of 24 in Swindon, and then the others are in London. So we have the showroom in London and that's the kind of sales marketing operation. But in Swindon, they're all, you know, it's a very nice place to be. It's a lovely workshop.
Did you know that there are nearly 1 million 18 to 24 year olds who are currently not in education, employment, or training? In the UK. This is simply not good enough, and I want to do something about it. That's why Reed is launching a new initiative, giving £20,000 to young entrepreneurs to help them grow their small business. Visit reed.com/entrepreneurs to find out more. We want to support and encourage the next generation of entrepreneurs. And your showroom is in the Pimlico Road in London. There are other businesses in the strip, if that's right.
Oh, yeah, so Pimlico
Road. That are related businesses, aren't they?
Yeah.
Which is interesting. It's a sort of cluster of
It's
design.
A cluster, yeah. It's one of the great streets for interior design
Describe it to people who may not know it?
Well, it's in Belgravia, which is kind of Sloane Square and Victoria, the nearest tube. So. And it was, I think in the 60s, it grew up as a kind of antique shop kind of street and became known for that with a few fabric suppliers. And it's slowly over the years, more and more kind of design fabric interiors companies have opened. Then it's very high end.
Yeah.
And it's actually very unusual now. I can't think of another street in the world in a way, which is kind of quite like that. There isn't one in New York. I don't know of any others. Yeah, and our landlords are curating it, I think, quite carefully now. But it's kind of they want to keep it like that, and it's also very important to somehow to the American market because the Americans are very aware of it as a street. So it's kind of quite a good thing to have a.
So you made a conscious decision to locate in this street.
So we started in Lotts Road, which is near Chelsea Harbour.
Yes.
Chelsea Harbour Design Centre, to be near the interior designers. So we're selling mostly to interior designers. I mean, over the years, it's been kind of 50-50, but now it's more and more, it's kind of 80% interior designers now. So we're in Lotts Road near to the Chelsea Harbour Design Centre. And then we made a conscious decision to move to Pimlico Road for the brand and to have a high street and not a high, you know, a presence on the street and a shop.
But people can come and visit and have a look whether they're an interior designer or not.
Yeah. And it's really nice. And it is very big. You know, the Americans like it. And a lot of Americans are shopping in the streets. And people, designers will bring their clients to the street to shop. And so it's a very, very good place
because
to be.
I think this is a really interesting business model that was very common in the past. You know, the jewelers would be in the same district.
Yeah, right.
And they sort of still are, I suppose, in Hatton Garden to an extent. But I think it makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Because people can buy from multiple sources at once. They can see what's going on in the same place.
I think so. I mean, shoe shops do it very famously. Cluster.
Yeah.
And I think it's really good.
The cluster strategy is a good one.
Yeah. And there are, and Mayfair is another kind of district where there's quite a lot of interiors, galleries and that sort of thing. But there's not a shop quite, and also Pimlico Road is incredibly kind of pretty, and it's a very nice place to walk around.
Yeah, which all helps. So you've also got a showroom in New York. How long have you had that?
We've had that for about 3 years.
So that's relatively new.
Relatively new,
Big step.
Big step. Yeah, felt like a big step, actually. And New York is an important, America is very important to us, and we've been selling in America for quite a long time, like 10 years, probably.
Right. So what outlets were you selling through?
So we sell through other showrooms. So there's a whole, the thing about America, there's a very kind of, I think, well sort of evolved ecosystem for interior design. So there are these design centers in every city. So New York has 3 design centers.
Right.
You know, we only have one in London, and that's Chelsea Arbor. I think that's the only one in Europe probably. But America has one in every big city, and the design centers are full of big showrooms which have, it's kind of what we call multi-line showrooms.
Right.
So they'll be representing 30 brands and furniture brands, a lot of them. And
but this requires a big space.
It requires a big space.
Big
so
buildings.
There are lots of...
There's more space in America for that than...
I mean, the Dallas Design District, Design Center, is gigantic. And the LA...
And you're represented in Dallas.
Yeah,
in
and the
way.
Pacific Design Center in LA is the size of an airport. It's incredible. Right. And so we are represented in LA by... somebody called Thomas Lavin, we've just actually started with them. And then in probably 8 cities now we're represented. So we're representing other showrooms, multi-line showrooms. We're a small part of their offer.
Yeah.
But, each one does a certain turnover.
People listening in America can find you quite
easily. Yeah, exactly. So we're in, I could list them all.
That's a challenge. List some of the big places.
We're in
Dallas.
We're in LA, Dallas, San Francisco, Denver, Atlanta, Chicago, Boston. Can't remember in Washington or not. I think we are
coming
quite,
soon. But, if
yeah,
not.
Coming soon. and Florida.
Fantastic. And now you've got your showroom in New York.
And we have our own showroom in New York. So we opened our own showroom just because New York is such an important area as well. You know, this our biggest, the biggest numbers are in New York. And I think to have our own space was somehow very good for the other showrooms, and to have a kind of, a foothold in America, a kind of footprint.
Helps establish your brand. That's
it makes
thinking,
us seem legit in America. And I think that's important. And then everybody in America is actually, our clients, they're moving around a lot. They are the kind of people who move a lot, and they are going through New York a lot. And we might be working with somebody in Denver or in Atlanta,
They might have multiple properties.
And they're definitely going to be in New York at some point, sort of thing.
People tend to pop through New York.
Yeah. So it's really useful. And I think it's good for brand. And,
So how are sales in America going?
Sales in America are good. Yeah.
Good. Well, I'm pleased to hear that.
God
bless America. So it's been a good good move. Been a good move going to America.
I mean, it has been a good move, yeah.
Yeah.
It's definitely good. And, they are very...
The economy in America seems to be more buoyant than
the economy
in the
more
UK
buoyant.
At the moment. So
there are a lot of people in America, and there's a lot of... money, there's a lot of wealthy people, there are a lot of interior designers. And the thing, the whole ecosystem, the thing is, if you are decorating your house, you do have an interior designer, and that's kind of quite a normal
thing.
That's
normal
to do.
In America.
Yeah, and you're guided by your designer. And there are a lot of people, and they might be multiple homeowners, and they will have one designer in New York who'll be doing all of them.
So a lot of your business is about building relationships with these individuals.
With interior designers?
Yes.
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's really good. We, obviously do that.
So you have a few loyal designers already by the sound of it.
Yeah, that's what, definitely, we have a few who come back. So this, I guess, in the sort of business sense, the interior designers are sort of our salespeople because, you know, we sell to them and then we hope they're going to sell us to their clients. But America,
do they have a deal, the interior designers?
They have a deal, they get a discount.
They get a discount.
Something known as a trade discount,
Well, that's how it works, I think, generally, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's
it. And in the, with the showrooms, anyway, there are discounts.
Yeah.
Galore. No, there are discounts.
So opportunities for negotiation.
Yeah, that's how it works.
What I find actually very appealing about your business is you've maintained your sort of hands-on artisan approach.
Mm.
You haven't gone to sort of grow it into a massive company. You've kept it sustainable and true to its original.
Sort of, yeah.
Not sort of.
Completely deliberately, but that's how it is. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't mind if it had got.
Growth
is good. It's growth. It's growing and it's grown slowly over the years, and it grows a bit every year. So,
but I suppose I'm a believer in organic growth in business.
Yeah. It has been like that. It's been all organic. It's never been any investment. And
since that purchase of the workshop in Swindon.
So that's good. And the kind of making in England is kind of important to me. I mean, I don't think everything should be made in England, but I like to make things in England. And I do like to kind of, I often sometimes do talks in schools and things. And I would, I like to encourage younger people or to let them know that there's a career to be had with working with your hands. And I think that's very important.
More so than ever, with AI taking so many.
Well, exactly. And also I think people are very interested in how things are made. I mean, particularly our clients and wealthy people, they're very interested in things and want to know stuff. And they love to come to the workshop and see how something gets made. And it is fascinating, to know how anything is made, a pencil.
Yes.
It's fascinating. And when you come to our workshop, it's really, what they do is incredibly skilled and difficult, and no one really knows who gets a table. They never know really what's gone into it.
So everyone is different in that they're all handmade.
Everything's handmade. Everything's handmade, And handmade by human beings. So, a lot of handmade things are just CNC controlled machines or whatever. With us, the finishers, they're actually touching the pieces to feel, they have to know how they feel to know if they're ready, if they're done.
For people who can't see Tom at the moment, he's stroking the testing table. Out our table, which looking at it is not handmade, I'm ashamed to say.
But you'd want this edge to feel just right.
You're giving it the once over, I can see.
Because people are going to touch it. So when they're finishing in the workshop, they think, that's
so
done.
So this is very important, though, isn't it, to the customers?
Yeah.
You can explain how this is done. And it's.
Yeah.
I think it's the made in England aspect. I imagine that's quite compelling in America.
I think it's compelling in America. And it's British design they like as well. I mean, English, British design. I think the whole Swindon. So I've set up this workshop in Swindon, and everyone who works there in my workshop, they're not all kind of welders in inverted commas. They are kind of people who kind of like making things and have done some welding, maybe. Some are actually welders, but mostly they're kind of people who have done a bit of welding, done a DIY, worked in sort of making or building or something, and then they come to work for me, and then they learn how we make things and the methods we use to weld and fabricate is kind of essentially what we're doing, and finish. And we have these specialist painters who are doing the specialist finishes on the furniture, and that's all unique to us. All that technique is totally developed by us, and we've got like 20 different finishes, and they've all learnt how to make things how we like to make them. And I just find it very, I love that exists in Swindon. And people, they're making things which, these, I think, beautiful pieces which are then delivered around the world. And it's a kind of, I hope it's a kind of fulfilling thing to be doing.
It sounds like it's a sort of very specific expertise that's been developed over time.
Yeah, it is now. Yeah, yeah. Because people
try irreplaceable, actually.
Well, some bits are. Yes. Why I'm worried about Nigel, as he's older than me.
Right.
But he's, I mean, he's, yeah, he has to pass, well, he's, there's lots of things he knows, which, you know, is good. That, I mean, he's passed most of it on to
and
the idea.
You began, as you said, working with wood, but is it now all metal?
All metal. So with tables, they have metal bases, but they have wooden tops.
Right.
And we have a cabinetry department as well. So we make some, we do some cabinetry and wooden tops, and we use marble tops and glass tops.
Right.
So, but all the bases and all the chairs are all made of metal. And that's,
do you have a signature piece?
We do, yes, called Capricorn.
Capricorn. Yeah. Could you describe that so people?
Ah, well, it's it's made of two big curves, basically, and it is a sort of classical. The motif is quite classical, but it's quite a contemporary table, and I think that's one of the things why it's become. It's one of the first things I made in metal, in sheet metal. Sheet metal is our absolute thing. That's what we're really best at. So it's one of the first things I ever made, and it's one of the first things Nigel made. And it's become our kind of signature piece because we're just, it's kind of known for it. It's called Capricorn, so named because it looked like the horns of a goat,
right,
which is the star sign. I think what's good about it is kind of very simple and it's contemporary, yet it has a kind of classical motif, which people don't realize, but it's kind of, and it doesn't really fight with other things.
Could I ask, how much would one of those cost typically?
Good questions. I'm never the best person to ask about the prices, but I mean, tables on the whole, they go, you can get, I think the least expensive table is about probably 6,000 or 7,000, and they can go up to 40,000.
Yeah.
And it depends on the material normally and the finish.
So your designers would be deciding those details and discussing with your colleagues.
And it might be made of bronze. So we work with bronze quite a lot.
So that'd be more expensive.
If it's bronze and marble, it's going to be really expensive, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're beautiful materials. And
sure, and I imagine they're long-lasting things.
Well, they will last forever. I mean, marble generally has already lasted for 4 or 5 million years. Or whatever. I mean, 250 million. I don't know.
It's old. It's built to last, is what you're saying.
They're built to last, yeah. So, yeah, important. And I mean, and one of the things I love about, this is a side issue about the built to last, I now have quite a lot of people who bought tables from me, you know, like 25 years ago, 30 years ago, and occasionally I meet them and they're still very attached to the pieces and they kind of talk about the dinner parties or the, you know, they had them before they got married and all the people they've entertained around them and they have all these sort of memories attached to them. And I think that's so, I kind of really love that. It's just so nice.
It sounds, listening to you, it seems like you've sort of taken furniture to a sort of different level. You know, a table is a sort of utility, becomes a work of art or a part of the family's sort
of... They can be...
History.
Yeah, I think they are.
I mean, my table, you're looking at it quite with some disdain. it's not a work of art or part of our family's history, but maybe we should replace it with one of yours.
It's very good. I mean, it's very nice and it has
a nice, rounded
end. You know, you spend a lot of time around
the table at home.
Really
thought of it like that.
Some tables we make, they're the heart of the home. And you're doing your homework on them. You're doing your emails. You're doing your artwork. If you're young or anyone, you know, you're kind of doing everything at the big kitchen table. And I love that. I love that idea.
So your signature piece is a table called Capricorn.
It's called Capricorn, yeah. But we have others.
So are there other keys?
We have key design. We have about
nine key
designs, motifs. So everything I do starts with a kind of a two-dimensional silhouette, basically.
Right.
So when you look at all of our designs, you can see the silhouettes. And we have one called Ava, which is a very strong silhouette. It's very kind of geometric. We just made one called Sky, which I love, which looks kind of like a ring almost. It's very kind of monumental and looks... It's inspired by Barbara Hepworth. And, you know, I love that collection. We have one called Papillon, which is the French for butterfly, in case you didn't know. And it looks, it sort of has veins, because somehow it's a kind of butterfly. And the others, X is a big one, EXE.
Right.
Memphis coffee table is a hit.
Memphis, the coffee table.
Yeah.
Right. So they're like family members. They've all got their own names.
And Memphis has recently got a new friend. It's a side table. to go with the coffee table.
And what's Memphis's friend called?
Well, it's called Memphis the side table.
Memphis the side table.
As opposed to Memphis the coffee table.
Okay, very
good. But that's good. It's been a very good, you know, there's just a few, we have a big collection, but there are a few pieces which somehow stand out.
So you say you've just introduced side table. Is it hard to predict the popularity of what's coming next? So that's quite a skill, isn't it, deciding what you're going to produce next? Because a big investment in these items, I imagine.
Yeah, James, well, it is a kind of skill, but it's not a skill I have really acquired, I don't think. I mean, because I don't really, never really made things, kind of make what I like to make.
Right.
And that's what I've done mostly. And when we launch a new collection, it's because it's an idea I've had and I think it will look great. And that's kind of
But how many items would you make for it to be a collection? You have to make a commitment.
Well, there's normally, if it's a collection, it would be a dining table and occasional table. So console, side table, coffee table. That's enough for a collection. So three pieces would be a collection.
Right.
But I mean, there's an argument for thinking a bit more carefully about what people actually want and then making something, I don't know, we kind of do that a bit, but mostly...
So some people say to you, I'd love something that did...
There's a bit of that. But mostly, I think the
important thing is... But it's not bespoke, is it, from what you're saying?
We have a whole collection called Avenues, which is very simple kind of square frames, which are very useful. They're kind of square. They're coffee tables, console tables, side tables, and you can have them with glass, marble, wood, any sort of finish. So they're very utilitarian somehow, but they're really nice, really well made, and love, you know, they're just right. But I think what I've made over the years have been things that I want to make myself, kind of. That's why I made them, because I think this is it looks beautiful, and it's, you know, I hope people will buy it. And I think, you know, if you like something, you've got to assume somebody else might like it.
Well, it's important to feel fulfilled in one's work, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
So if you didn't like it, that would be problematic.
That would be problematic. Yeah, I wouldn't want to. Yeah, there isn't a piece I make, apart from possibly one or two, but there isn't really a piece that I don't like.
I mean, you've been doing this for 30 years. So
yeah.
I'm assuming that you...
Yeah, and also...
feel very sort of connected to your work.
Yeah, I do. And I think I've often said before, it's a bit like music. You know, when you hear a piece of music for the first time, you kind of... whatever, and then you hear it again and you like it, and then the more you hear it, the more you like it. But sometimes the more you hear it, the more you don't like it. But you know, when you actually, almost everything I've made, like the more I look at them, the more I think, yeah, that's actually quite good.
Right.
And some, you know, I really think, oh.
So it's not like you look back at your early stuff and think, oh, I don't like that anymore.
No, not really, no. And some of the very early stuff, because that's our 30th anniversary, which I might have mentioned, but some of the very early stuff, the patterns and things, the painted stuff, I'm thinking of maybe doing something with those, which for a long time I was a bit kind of embarrassed by them in a way. They seemed a bit naive somehow, and because I was young. But now they seem to just be part of the story, and actually I think they're, you know, they've got something, and you know, I did like them at the time, so
why not? Yeah, I think it's interesting that the story is so much a part of the product. As for listening to you, I mean, buying a table with this whole journey of yours is fundamental to its sort of appeal, isn't it?
For the customer,
yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and people,
the fact your commitment to it, your love of what you do, and this feels fundamental to me.
Yes. And people do spend a lot of time choosing a table. I mean, it's they are investment pieces, as we call them.
Yeah, investment pieces, sounds good. So you can make a big or a small investment.
Yeah, exactly.
But it does sound long-lasting.
They're long-lasting. They're made of metal. I mean, they are going to last for a long time. I don't know if you've ever tried to get rid of a metal table, but it's quite difficult. I mean, you can't chop it up for firewood.
No, that's true. No one else can either.
No. So they will last.
So they become family heirlooms, I guess.
I mean, in theory, they will last,
several lifetimes.
Many lifetimes, yeah.
Yeah.
And I dread to think how many there
are. So do you have much repeat business? I suppose your interior designers will be the repeat.
Ideally, we don't get people replacing, but we do some refurbishments. But no, on the whole,
and do they tend to be for home and families, or do you do business
they
premises?
Are domestic. What we call residential.
Yeah.
And we do a little bit for hotels and sort of more boutique type hotels, and might do an entrance table or something like that. But we never do kind of all of the bedside tables for a big hotel. Yeah. We couldn't compete. And anyway, yeah.
No, fair enough. So what are your biggest challenges at the moment, sort of running a business that fabricates in Britain, sells in the United States? I mean, I can think of several things that might be.
Yeah. Well.
Exercising your mind.
The global state of the world, as it's known, is one thing. It seems to be, there's sort of confidence in the economy. And we're very connected to the housing market, really, because, people are often, there have been ups and downs over the years, and there have been, the financial crisis was a down. And at that time, we were doing a lot of what used to be called show house furniture, so for property developers.
Mm.
And there were loads and loads of show houses being built all the time. We were always doing a table and six chairs for the something, whatever, show house. And the crash, that kind of all stopped. So all the show houses, they just stopped doing them.
Right.
So that was a problem then. But now, there's interest rates are high, and that it's been, that's sort of, I think, problematic. And there has been a bit of kind of clients putting things on hold, not quite sure at the moment, going to make a decision in six months, and you get a bit of that. So that's always a challenge. But I think I feel you kind of had to ride that and hope that it will come back, and, you're making something that you believe in, and there's the high value and high quality. So
how have you handled the tariffs with America?
Tariffs, for us, they were kind of okay. So they weren't that high. They were 10%.
Yeah.
And there's always been a line on the invoice of, shipping, customs, tax, something. Yeah. And in the first month, we actually paid the tariffs for the customers. So I think it was in April, and we said, don't panic. We'll pay the tariffs until the end of April.
That hit your margin, though?
Hit our margin, but it was just, we thought it would be kind of a good thing to do. Because I think otherwise there was a bit of a freeze on, because everyone kind of panicked a bit.
Yeah.
So I think that was quite good that we did
that.
And
then settled down,
and then it was all absolutely fine, yeah. And it's been fine ever since. And I think particularly in America, people say that, Americans, if they want their stuff, they want their stuff.
Right.
And that's,
they want your stuff.
It is a unique product. You can't get it anywhere else. It's a long-term investment, so I think, but, they were 10%, so they weren't 45%.
No.
So that was a flutter.
Right. And so do you spend quite a lot of time in America, Tom?
I do, yeah. I spend quite a lot of time in America. I've just been there, actually.
So you spend time with customers?
Yeah, I like to, yes.
Where did you go most recently?
Well, I went to New York last week just to see the showroom and catch up with the people. We have two people in New York only.
Right.
We have two and three in total, if you count them all. But one is...
are they all
roving
on the WhatsApp group?
Yeah, they are, yes, actually. So I have two or three people in America, but I went to New York to see the showroom and to meet some clients and just do a little bit of networking. So I love to go to New York.
I mean, the WhatsApp group, for a business of a certain size, sounds like a pretty good idea. Do you put a lot of stuff on it? Do you engage with it quite a bit?
I put on things like, if we've got a piece in a magazine or something, I put that on so everyone can see it. Because the workshop...
like a company newsletter in the old days sort of thing.
So we've had this divide between London and the workshop, which is kind of...
Right.
And we have team days and everything gets together. But, the workshop is big. There are lots of people and they often don't know actually what's sort of happening. They don't know that...
Unless someone tells them,
They know they're making something for a show. They don't really know what the show is or whatever. So we try and let people know. So we have a monthly... I think a three-monthly all-staff meeting where we all get together and I tell everybody sort of what the plans are, what's been happening. And then on the WhatsApp, I'll put on, if there's a nice Instagram post or something, I might put that onto the WhatsApp. And the main problem is the birthdays, because everyone seems to have a birthday virtually every day, as far as I can see. So we've had a kind of... almost a moratorium on birthdays. I think no one's really mentioned them in 2026.
It's been crowding
I don't
the
know
WhatsApp
why.
Group, is it?
Yeah, suddenly, I think somehow...
As soon as you have one, everyone's got to go on,
I think we decided not to do them, and then... Or someone... Anyway, I've hardly seen one this year, so anyway, that's what it came to.
Come and go then. Well, I suppose that's it's how the group's used.
Yeah, but so, like everything, we have a showroom WhatsApp group and a workshop only WhatsApp group.
Right.
And, if, you know, who knows? There may be lots of other groups.
Probably not a lots party of other to. Groups. Yeah, the yeah. party group. Yeah. Tom, I mean, you've described the team in the workshop. Yeah. When you're busy designing, who's running the business? How does that work? Because you're very much on the creative side, as I'm hearing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, I'm known as creative director. But the other key person in the business, apart from Nigel, who I mentioned, mm-hmm. is Miranda Kerwin, who's our CEO. And she's worked for me for 24 years. We've worked together for 24 right. years. And we have kind of, you know, she came to work one day a week on sales in 2003 or something. And then she left to have another child. And then she came back and she worked another 2 days and 3 days. And then she slowly...
Yeah.
So for a long time now, she's been full time, and me and her have kind of grown the business together. So she's been a very important part of the whole journey. So it's Nigel, the workshop, Miranda in the office, and me, and we're the three really.
Right. So you run it like a triumvirate in a sense.
Except for Nigel doesn't wish to have any part in running of anything right. because he likes making things.
He likes
things.
Making but, things. Well, that's what that
so me
sounds like
Miranda and I kind of run it yeah. together. And yeah, that she's been great.
So you've grown this business organically over time.
Yeah.
Do you ever, looking back, think maybe it would have been interesting to have taken an outside investment to sort of accelerate your growth or expand more quickly or open other workshops or go around the world? I mean, some businesses are very aggressive.
Yeah.
But
I mean, I would have...
You haven't done that.
That would have been quite interesting in a way, but I think I'm not very business minded either in a way. I mean, it's not kind of the thing that drives me. I don't really know. I've never wanted to make a huge business, but I like having a successful and profitable and secure business.
Yes.
But that, in a way, that's kind of enough for me.
Fair enough. So you've really enjoyed and focused on the design and building.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's where you want to keep it.
Yeah, I think so.
I think that's really... well, sort of observed, because why every business needs to grow at some great accelerated rate is not obvious to me. There are lots of businesses that continue for long periods doing really good work.
Yeah, and also I think...
Like yours.
And a lot of businesses are, you know, very focused on the exit. So, you know, and I am very interested in the people, you know, and I do really like, as I mentioned before, but, you know, the people who work in the workshop. That has just been a real pleasure to kind of be part of that.
So you put people first?
Well, I'd like to think so, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds to me like you absolutely do. And, you know, I think focusing on exits maybe is to the detriment of the customer
it depends
and
what
the
your,
people in the business.
Yeah.
I mean,
It depends what the point is of your business. I mean, the point isn't for an exit. The point is to make the things I want to make.
Yeah.
And it is to work with people I like working with, and to have, you know, it's a pleasure to, you know, work with people who feel kind of invested and valued, and, you know, that what a nice thing to do.
And what a great message, I might add.
Yeah.
I think that's so important. In terms of your future plans, are you most excited about? What are you looking at doing next?
Good question. Well, this is our 30th anniversary.
Yeah, it sounds like a big moment.
So we're trying to do some kind of collaborations and things for this year. Most of them unconfirmed, but that's an idea. I think...
When you say collaboration, these sort of collabs are often spoken about in design and retail.
Yeah.
So a couple of examples would be interesting, just the things you might have done in the past.
We haven't done that many, but ones which we'd like to do this year is something with a fashion brand.
Right.
So something kind of in our space in a way, but not quite. But has a reach of a similar kind of audience. And I want to do a jewellery collaboration, possibly with someone to make some jewellery. And I'd like to do a collaboration with some sort of up-and-coming brands and then some established brands.
Right.
So I mean, I think we're going to get one with a photographer. Perhaps.
So anyone listening who might be interested in reaching out to you should think that Tom's open to collaborations.
Yeah, no, that definitely, yeah. Yeah. The... I have a very good a friend in New York who's a photographer who we might do something with him. That's just the idea I was talking about last week while I was there. So doing some kind of cool, he takes amazing kind of art, fine art type photos. So doing something with him. And so some little things like that. But otherwise, I mean...
And the purpose of that part, I mean, it sounds fun, but is to sort of extend the reach of the brand.
Extend the reach, yeah. It's all about the reach. Because I think that's one thing we haven't been... We spend a lot of time concentrating on our, what we call, you know, our gold customers, our silver customers. So we have sort of groups of people who are important and, you know, but I think we need to spend more time just trying to spread the word and, you know, find, reach new people. And you can obviously do that on social media quite easily. But I think collaborations seem to me like an obvious way to do it. If you've got someone with a big following and you do something together, hopefully there'll be some cross-pollination.
That seems to be the way it works because a lot of people do them. So I imagine they get upside from it.
I know. It's funny, isn't it, how they're the thing to do.
They are. The collabs are very popular. So you also, I understand, maybe putting something important into Swindon.
Oh, yeah. Good.
So, installation, or is that right? Or what's happening in Swindon? Because I think this has been your home for a long time, hasn't it?
So Swindon is important to me, and it's kind of often... Kind of slightly, people don't. I mean, it has not a great reputation somehow. I'm not quite sure why it's got like that. But anyway, it's an amazing piece of the world, you know, part of the world in Wiltshire, and beautiful country all around. And it is culturally not that much going on in it. But anyway, so I'm very fond of Swindon, and everyone who works for me virtually lives in Swindon. And you know, it's been a great place for me. And there is a redevelopment happening at the moment, a kind of regeneration of one of the shopping centres. And I hope we're going to put a sculpture into a kind of public sculpture into it. And I've been talking to the planners.
Oh, excellent.
You know, the landscape designers about it and having some ideas. And so that would be great. There's nothing I'd like more than to have a public sculpture in Swindon.
Well, I really hope that happens because I'd be very pleased to see that too as I go there quite regularly.
Yeah.
That would be a great addition. Swindon, I'm told, is often used by marketeers as a typical British town.
That's right,
town.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
The demographics are sort of pretty much mirror the country. I don't know if that's still the case. But
I don't know. But it has gone down. I mean, when
I first... It's had a tough time recently, factories closing and things.
Well, the Honda closed. That was 5,000 people. A lot of people. And then, you know, I think like all towns, the shopping centre, the high street is being hollowed out, but mostly the shopping centre, which when I first moved there had a House of Fraser in it and a Jessop's Photographers and a Burton's Menswear, what it had. And now it literally really only mostly has charity shops. And
unfortunately, that is a pattern that's repeated in many towns.
And I think it's a bit like that. So I'm not sure what they're going to, you know, I'm not sure what any towns do actually to put that right. But people talk about residential. You need to get people to go and live in these unused office spaces.
So that might be the next chapter. Yeah. But that takes a lot of investment, doesn't it?
Yeah. One of the Signal House, which I don't know if you know, Swindon Railway Station, is a giant office block, which has been derelict now for 15 years. I mean, it's been empty and now derelict. It's kind of, it's so
right
sad.
Near the station.
It's one of the kind of landmarks of Swindon, yeah.
Why don't they remove? Yeah, I don't know. It's sad.
Pretty big. I imagine that somebody will redevelop it at some point, but I don't know when.
But ideally, into residential, I suppose. Yeah. So, in terms of your next developments in the business, are you planning some new ranges as well as these
I want to do something
collections,
something
30th
new.
Collection.
Yeah, I want to do something for 30 years. So some kind of a new piece. But what I'm interested in at the moment is sculpture, because I'm thinking of going beyond. Because throughout my career, my creative career, I've had to make things which are, I've channeled all of my creative ideas into tables, basically.
Right.
So I'm now going to start channeling more of them into sculptures.
Right.
So I'm interested in doing that. And we do make a sculpture, which is quite successful. And I'd just like to do work a bit bigger.
Right.
And work with
things. What's the sculpture you do make?
It's called Arizona. And it's kind of, it looks like it's inspired in a way by the Brancusi Infinite Column. I don't know if you know that.
Right.
It's in Romania. It's amazing, very tall. It's just a kind of geometric shape.
Right.
And It does very well. Anyway, I'd like to do more sculpture because I just find it kind of interesting.
Is that the same customer that would be?
We do. Exactly.
So you're diversifying in a sense.
Yeah, in a way. Yeah. I mean, there are lots of things I would quite like to do, but never quite get around to doing, you know, like limited edition collections or, you know, more art pieces. And then the sculpture might be a bit more of an art project. But so I would like to be a sculptor for 30 years and maybe something with one of the very earliest collections, which we don't make anymore. So to resurrect something from the past.
You said something interesting about the sort of customer, that they're very fascinated in how things are made and the sort of craft involved. Is this something that's becoming more widespread? It's interesting to me. This seems to be.
Yeah, I think it is.
So what's happening here? Yeah,
I don't know. I think it is. I think because there's more access to it. There's something called, you might have spotted it on Instagram, BTS, behind the scenes.
Right.
People are very interested in that. People are showing it a lot now on Instagram. Behind the scenes, like how do you make this?
And some
of it you don't want to kind of ruin the magic, but a lot of it is the magic, I think. And I think once you know what goes into something, you know, if you see people often come into our. Well, I remember actually 20 years ago or 30 years ago, I had a shop in East London and the guy came and he said, well, it's £2,000 for a few bits of bent metal and walked out. And I thought, well, you actually know what's gone into that. And you know, a lot of work. And so when you see what they do and what, because everything we make starts with a few old bits of metal, you know, like look, like nothing, a few sheets of metal lying on the floor. And something I love, sometimes I go to the workshop, like there'd be loads of bits of, you know, metal lying sort of on the floor, on the racks, and they're just bits of metal. And then come back in a few weeks and they've all kind of turned into these pieces of furniture or whatever, which are going to, you know, exist in the world forever. And there's a real magic, I think, in the creative process from zero to something. And they really, you know, and I think the more people know about that, the better. And I think somehow there is an appetite.
That's very interesting. So it sounds to me, you know, if people are involved in making things, this behind the scenes sort of aspect is something that's very useful for them to consider as well. I mean, you've found that helpful.
Yeah, definitely. No, it's really good. And we have workshop tours. So if you're a designer or a member of the public, you can come along.
How often are they?
Whenever people ask if they can come, and then we try and combine it with some other people.
So they can come onto your website.
And then we're having an open day in a few weeks.
Right.
Where we've invited people if they'd like to come. So our kind of favourite designers and other designers.
Fantastic. So what's your web address, Tom, if anyone wants to do that?
It's,
or get a hold of you?
It's tomfaulkner.co.uk.
Right. So if they wanted to join in and they could come and find you there.
And I think that's good. So the open days, I like that idea. Do you remember, you might remember Play School, but I'm not sure if anybody else does.
I do remember Play School. There were three different windows.
Yeah, through the round window. And it was so fascinating. You'd go through the round window and you'd see how a milk bottle was made. It's just really interesting.
It is.
No one knows how anything is made.
Yeah, that's very true. It's sort of people lost touch with that. Yeah. And maybe they're trying to refine it.
More and more that people must have lost touch because...
I mean, it applies to so many things. Food, I mean, is the most obvious.
Yeah, exactly.
We buy so much stuff. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. I mean, in the old days, I mean, there's a time if you bought a suit, you'd have to go and see someone to make it for you, probably.
Yes.
I don't know. But so we're getting more removed from...
A big part of your approach is to reconnect people with that knowledge and interest.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And you've found that works as a customer relationship strategy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I think it's good for the workshop. And I've been around a lot of workshops as well myself, and not all of them are great. You know, you go to one somewhere, you think this is a bit odd almost what's happening here and now.
In what sense?
Well, sometimes how the person who's walking around talks to the people there, or how it's not a great atmosphere, or they're not being, I don't know, some, I've been to a few and some are really good. And when you go to a nice workshop where everyone feels, you can tell they're kind of valued and enjoying what they do, it's, you know, that you think, great, I'd love to.
I feel the same when you walk into an office. You know, if I walk into an office, I can tell within 30 seconds whether it's a successful, thriving unit or not.
Yeah, right, exactly.
There's a sort of energy it gives off.
Yeah.
So it's the same with workshops.
I think so.
And you, and so sort of assembling and keeping the team together is really important.
Yeah.
So you, you obviously hire people who you train.
Yeah. But in the workshop.
What do you look for from in the people you hire? Because you've successfully built a very loyal team, which is a key ingredient to business success.
Yeah, we have a lot of
how do you do this?
Old timers and long stayers. Yeah, we.
But they are they then bring on the other people. Or
yeah, they
teach
do.
Them
yeah,
their skills.
Ideally, yeah. So yeah. I think we've got 11 people. Two have been with me for 20 years or more, or and then about five have been more than 10 years, and then
the so that's like your core
been
team
there for more than 5 years. So so there's a real core in the workshop, which is really important. And for hiring people, I don't really know. I mean, I'm not. I find recruitment one of the most difficult.
We can help with that, Tom. but do you have a sense of what qualities you might look for? In
Well, I want, you know, sort of can-do, friendliness, creative thinkers. But I find what's interesting in a way about recruitment is sometimes you don't spot people who turn out to be amazing.
No.
At the time, and you don't spot people who turn out to be terrible at the time. You know, in the interview,
you
think
don't.
Somebody's amazing. God, I'd never realized, when we interviewed them, I didn't realize they just, you know, they have these qualities which you can't quite define or see. But anyway, so I think
that's one of my great anxieties is turning away someone who turns out to be brilliant somewhere else.
Yeah, because they are being exactly.
You never know, actually.
You never know, and they are being interviewed, which is probably a skill in itself.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a skill in itself, I imagine.
But that core team you describe, it reminds me of someone saying, you know, if you want to win the World Cup in football, you need to have five world-class players, at least.
Yeah, right.
It doesn't matter if you have
Right, exactly.
Or, if you've got five, you're flying, sort of thing.
Yeah, I think we do. We have really, really good core. And
so you've developed that and cherished that over time.
Yeah, and in Swindon, you know, they all kind of, they're very kind of supportive. They're a very nice team there. You know, they are supportive of each other and they organise a quiz night for themselves every now and then. And they're just always, and, you know, I don't know, that seems to be.
So is there any advice, Tom? I mean, you were an accidental entrepreneur, as described. You sort of picked it up and you had a side hustle or a hobby that you liked. Is there any advice you'd give to young entrepreneurs or your younger self? I mean, we're trying to encourage entrepreneurship in the UK.
Yeah, right.
More fabricators would be great.
Yeah,
Is there anything you'd say to young people listening to think about or try?
Well, I think it is quite, it is very different now. And I mean, and people do often ask me for advice, like, you know, how I'm a maker, I've been to college and I've done this, and how do I start a business? And I think, you know, when I began, it was much more straightforward. What to do is like get a database. I mean, like I could ring up all of the interior designers were just listed in the Yellow Pages. So I could just get all their names and addresses. So, you know, that things were very straightforward. So now you have to do, you know, like collab, social media, this and that. And it's workshops are expensive. But so I think it is difficult to know what it's like now. But
or just to make people aware of you, you mean?
Just to make people aware of you. Yeah. It's a big competitive space. There are lots of people who are having a go at making something and making...
But you could ask ChatGPT to give you a list of all the interior designers, couldn't you?
Okay, I might try that. Yeah, yeah. With their phone numbers.
Yeah, I mean, I think people do that. I don't know whether the numbers are up to date.
Yeah, I don't know if it's GDPR credentials. But anyway.
Yeah, well, that would be maybe someone's problem somewhere. But yeah, the GDPR is tight.
But it was a bit more straightforward in that you did a fair or a show. You did the Bath craft show and you did the show in London.
Do these shows still exist?
Some do, probably. But the ones in London, there's some trade fairs don't really exist like they used to. It was not obvious where to exhibit. And then it was, you know, you could make the step, like the investment to exhibit where I did at the IDDI or something.
You start with a show.
And you see what happens. But I think, I mean, what I say to people, one thing obviously is go through doors if they open and see what happens, you know. And I think I have done that a lot. And a lot of things I did, like just buying the workshop. I got a shop in Exmouth Market, which is in Clerkenwell, and that was because a friend of mine had bought a flat above it, and it had an old butcher's shop underneath. And I had breakfast with him one morning, and he said, do you want to rent my butcher's shop? And it was in East London. I lived in Hammersmith, and the workshop was in Swindon, so it was the least convenient place.
Yeah.
But it was kind of quite a good thing to do in the end, as it turned out. And
So when these opportunities present themselves.
Yeah, maybe.
Is that what you mean by walk through the
doors?
Yeah,
I think so. Because there are, but then luck is a lot, plays a big part in what we all do, and you don't know what might lead to something. But I think if doors open, go through them. And specifically also in my world, I think, you know, if you're making furniture or something, take good photographs of it, because particularly now.
Right.
Because it's all in the image, you know, everyone, it's all that people are looking
at. And if
at,
you've
really.
Sold it, then you know, you need a good record.
Yeah,
and
but you're selling from imagery the whole time, so that's good. So I think, you know, it's expensive taking a good photograph, but you need to try to do that.
So does that mean getting a professional?
Yeah, I would say so, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, I would, if you can.
Or forming a relationship with a good photographer of some sort.
And there are lots of young photographers who probably be...
So there might be good collaborations that people could start with early on.
I think that's a good thing to do. And also, I think be nice to... Well, collect your database is really important. And I go to a lot of shows where people... It's the young designer show or whatever, and you're going on and asking them 100 questions about what they're doing, and then they don't ask you who you are. You know, they don't get your details. And you've just got to collect... People are interested in what you're doing. You've got to put them on your database.
Find out who they are, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And
in your experience, people are happy to give you their details if you ask them.
Yeah, on the whole, they are. Yeah. You know, that's almost always fine. And then be friendly to your, be nice to your customers and your suppliers.
Yes.
You know, because the other thing people, you know, your relationships with your suppliers are as important as the ones with your customers. And
a lot of business people overlook that.
Yeah. No, they really are.
To their cost.
Yeah. And you can get a lot out of a supplier. They can give you loads of advice. You know,
ideas.
Yeah, and they can give you, they recommend other people, and they can be really supportive. So I think that's good. So, but yeah, friendliness.
Well, no, that's very helpful advice. So, is there something you're really excited about, Tom? apart from your 30th celebrations.
I don't... there are, what am I really excited about? Well, America I find exciting as a prospect, and I think would be quite interesting to open a second showroom in America at some point on another coast.
Yes.
But that won't be for a bit.
America has three coasts.
Yeah, exactly.
So you haven't decided which.
Yeah, I don't want to give anything away at this point.
I'm not giving anything away. No, America sounds exciting. And I mean, exciting. Given you've been there 3 years, it sounds like you're doing a lot of business there.
And then I mean, personally, you know, I'm getting older. And I'm kind of excited to know what, with the next stage of the business is kind of exciting. Because then something needs to happen at some point in the next 3 or 5 years, probably.
And what have you in mind?
It's interesting, I think, how you spend all this time building up a business, and then you suddenly find, hang on, I've got to, you know, I've got to somehow get out of it, or something's got to happen to it, because I won't, be around.
I won't be able to do it forever.
And don't want to do it necessarily forever. So,
well, this is a thing that affects a lot of entrepreneurs.
Yeah. And you sort of forget. Well, I never thought of it when I started. I never thought.
Yeah.
Anyway, so now I'm just thinking that whatever happens, I want to really keep the Swindon, workshop as it is. And I personally just want to be able to kind of step back a bit, remove myself from it. Somehow, and do some more sculpture, or do explore my own kind of creative endeavors a bit more.
So, you, in a sense, you'd have to bring on a successor. Then
so
to keep
the succession and all that business. But I would hate to sell it to private equity or something, which would then move all the manufacturing to somewhere else.
Yes, that would be a great shame.
Yeah. So the only legacy, I think the workshop is the work that I've done.
Yes.
Which will hopefully kind of exist for a long time. And, there's the intellectual property around the designs. But then the actual workshop, I think, is a legacy which I'd like to sort of leave somehow.
Yeah, and that will hopefully continue.
Yeah.
Well, that's a big question to be thinking about. I mean, and that affects so many people in business. the idea of succession, yeah. legacy.
Yeah, and it's, a,
it's an important question, isn't
and
it?
Something to do well if you can.
Yeah,
because people can do it. I mean, it's difficult. I think it's difficult to do, and particularly if you're very, you know, some entrepreneurs are very, very involved and that can never step back and never, and you know, get in the way of the succession and whatever.
Yeah, it's the ultimate strategy in the end.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So it goes on after you.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Well, I wish you every success with that. Thanks so much for coming in
well,
to
thank
talk
you.
To me. I found that fascinating.
A great pleasure. Thank
really
you.
Interesting. And I'm going to look up all the different types of furniture, starting with Capricorn.
Yeah, great.
On your
Classic.
Website.
Yeah.
I always ask two questions right at the end of all of my guests. And the first question is, because we at Reed love Mondays, is what is it that gets you up on a Monday morning?
Mondays is a day, I normally actually spend Monday in the workshop.
Right.
It's one of my things, and somehow it seems to be where I am. And I think you probably what I was just saying about the workshop, I mean, I like being amongst the people, and that's what I love about the business in a way. And I like, and the workshop is kind of, I really do like being in there with everyone and being with the pieces, you know, the work. Yeah. So I think that's kind of what I look forward to is kind of
getting
seeing
into
everyone. And likewise, I do like going into the showroom in London and, you know, the people of the business are the main thing for me in a way. So I think that's what I love.
That's what gets you up.
Yeah.
To get into work with the team.
Somehow.
Well, that sounds very positive.
Yeah.
And then my last question, and that's sort of related to what we've just been talking about really, but is where do you see yourself in 5 years' time?
Yeah, so that's tricky, isn't it, at this age? Not tricky, but 5 years' time. I'd be very interested to see where I am in 5 years' time myself. And I want to be kind of stepped back, in inverted commas. I think that's the plan. And I'd like, you know, as I said, I'd like the workshop to kind of continue to be where it is. And, you know, it's a bit... The thing I've created, I think the workshop does feel to me like the most important thing. You know, it's the most important part of the whole business. And I really want to sort of safeguard that somehow or make sure that stays, whatever else happens. And then hopefully I can slowly remove myself from the whole thing. And I would like to, I do have ambitions to kind of have a different kind of life at some point, which doesn't involve going to Swindon the whole time. And I mean, spend a lot of time on the M4 and on the train.
Right.
But I would like to kind of have a go at doing something else, really. And it also, the other thing I'm also quite interested in is, you know, apart from my own kind of creative stuff, is maybe doing something with younger people, like some, not mentoring, but kind of showing, helping people to know that they can make stuff, you know.
Well, that'd be great.
And there could be a way of doing that, like using the workshop or something, you know, because I sometimes think, you know, we have this whole workshop which is closed at the weekends and, you know, we could have like a Saturday club in there where people could come to learn something. Or I'd love to work with somebody who would like to, or find somebody who would like to kind of...
Well, that's a great invitation
something.
There if anyone's listening.
Exactly,
has
so that would be fun.
Youth enterprise. Well, I wish you every success with that, and I hope that sculpture one day... is a central and special feature in Swindon.
Yep.
Thanks for coming to
Good.
Talk to me.
Thank you, James.
Tom, it's been a real pleasure.
It's been great. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Tom, for joining me on All About Business. I'm your host, James Reed, Chairman and CEO of Reed, a family-run recruitment and philanthropy company. If you'd like to find out more about Tom Faulkner or Reed, you'll find links in the show notes. Thank you for listening. And see you next time.